Hi everyone, welcome to Beef and Lamb New Zealand Seen and Heard podcast. So today we're going to be chewing the fat, to use a blatant and overdone pun, about cattle and carcasses and a wee bit about cows I think as well. Specifically talking about fine-tuning finishing performance in beef cattle and also the outcomes from the beef progeny test that are related to that. We'll talk a bit more in depth later about the beef progeny test and what it was. But firstly, I'm joined to talk about all that and more by Dr. Jason Archer from Beef and Lamb New Zealand Genetics. Welcome along, Jason. Before we start talking about cattle, let's talk about you.
Sure.
What do you do at Beef and Lamb New Zealand Genetics? What's that job entail, basically, just to set the scene?
Yeah. So my role is called Genetics Specialist for Livestock. And I guess I work in sort of our genetic strategy and sort of leading some of the work that we do in genetics across sheep and beef. And also as part of that, I guess I'm the science lead for a lot of our beef genetics research. So historically I've got quite a strong background in beef, less so in sheep, but obviously in genetics. So I spend a fair bit of my time thinking about different genetics issues across sheep and beef, but particularly beef.
Cool. And we're going to talk about the Informing New Zealand Beef Project, a bit more about Beef and Lamb New Zealand Genetics, a bit about the beef progeny test. How many are working on the broad field of beef genetics in the Beef and Lamb New Zealand Genetics team?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends on what you call our team, I suppose, because we use a bunch of contractors and that sort of things, and we like to regard them as part of the team as well. So, you know, roughly there's probably, 15 people involved at some reasonably deep level. Not all full-time, though. So there's a fair team.
Yeah, the reason I brought that up was it's fair to say, like, I think, you know, since early 2000s, 2001, Beef and Lamb New Zealand and its predecessors were involved with SIL, Sheep Improvement Limited, but the beef genetics side of thing has probably been, it's a growing field. We're getting more involved in that and more projects in that than probably we had in the past.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, really, from a New Zealand point of view, probably from the early 90s through to around about 2014, there was almost not nothing, because there was some work done at AgriSearch by Chris Morris, bits and pieces, but there wasn't a lot of work done in beef genetics per se across that period. And then in 2014, when Beef and Lamb Genetics was first formed, part of that was to sort of start working some stuff in beef. And probably the main activity at that point was to start up a progeny test, start getting data so that we can actually do stuff. From there, it's sort of been building from there.
Okay. Now, that was a wee bit of a segue I wanted to throw in, because I will refer people to the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel. And on that, we do have some podcasts about the Informing New Zealand Beef Project, which is one of the big players in town. If people want to hear more about that and some of the outcomes that that project's trying to achieve, then I definitely steer you towards that. But getting back to the topic at hand, we're going to go into some depth later around rib fat depth, intramuscular fat, some of the things out of the projects. But for those with short attention spans, and to set the scene and provide the summary about what we're going to go into, we're going to cut straight to some of the key bits. One of the key topics we're going to be talking about is subcutaneous fat on cattle, clearly, on cows, cattle, carcasses. In a nutshell, and I think this, hopefully, you know, most people have a fair handle on this, what's its importance? Why has this project been, I guess, spending so much time looking at it?
Yeah. So actually, you've sort of got to go to what's the importance of subcutaneous fat on the carcass. And carcasses need some fat cover around them, and it prevents what's called, what in the science world we call cold shortening, but basically as the carcass gets chilled down, if that chill down happens too fast, then the meat sort of contracts and becomes quite tough. And the fat around the outside of a carcass is an insulator that helps that meat cool at the right rate. And you don't need a heap of it. If you look at the meat company specs, the specs would say that between 3 and 10 mil is optimal. So that's the market signals that are there for fat cover. But yeah, it really is about a meat quality type of thing is the real reason to get that right. And you know, that's getting it right is a combination of the genetics that you have, but it's also how you feed your animals and when you kill them as well, obviously. And I think if you talk to some of the meat companies around the place, they would tell you that there are a lot of cattle killed in New Zealand that are not really properly finished. And by that, they really mean just probably don't really have enough of that subcutaneous fat to optimize meat quality. Hence the reason that we would like to get that right.
You talk about quality there, and the one you said was the cold shortening, you know, so that insulation effect. But what about quality in terms of what the customers would think in terms of how they eat it?
Yeah,
is
well,
it a role cold... there, or is it solely for that physical aspect?
Well, the cold shortening results in toughness, right? So, which is the number one killer of an enjoyable experience of eating a steak, right? A steak that is tough is not a nice eating experience. So that's the main driver from a subcutaneous fat point of view. And then, of course, there's other aspects of quality in eating steaks. And, you know, probably the one that we often talk about, and genetics has a big role in too, is the marbling, which is the fat inside of the meat rather than around the surface of, you know, the outside of the steak. So that's got a different role from that subcutaneous fat.
Yep. So that's IMF, intramuscular fat. You're talking about there, the marbling.
Yep, marbling, there's IMF, different ways of measuring it. Yep.
And we'll come to this in a moment, but there's a correlation or a relationship between those two. You don't tend to get one without the other, or you need rib fat to get intramuscular fat generally?
So from a finishing point of view, you need animals adequately finished to get that intramuscular fat. But from a genetics point of view, the correlation that's there is not that strong, right? So, and that's why we have different EBVs for fat around the outside. So you'll see them as rib and rump or rib and P8. P8 is just a specific name of a site on the rump. And you'll see those EBVs in bull sale catalogs and that sort of thing. And then you'll also see IMF percent, which is intramuscular fat percent, which is essentially marbling. And those EBVs were created, I guess you sort of got to think back. So they were created essentially out of Australia and breed plan, but the Americans do similar things with their genetic systems. They're created because, particularly in Australia, the feedlot sector opened up in the late 80s and 90s, and there was big premiums to get to a certain marble score. And at that time, it was the Japanese B3 market, which means muscle score B and marble score 3. But to get to that level of marbling, some of those carcasses were fed for, you know, 300 days on grain, and they'd come out with, you know, let's say 30 mils, you know, huge amount of fat around the outside of the carcass. And that's incredibly expensive way to get marbling, because fat is energetically really expensive to put on. So we're putting a lot of energy into this 30 mils of fat. And then the next thing we do is when we get the carcass, we've got to pay someone to trim it off. So it's expensive to take it off as well. So back in that time, the holy grail was to say, well, let's try and put the fat inside the meat. So that's the marbling, the IMF, and take it off the outside of the carcass. And that's really why those EBVs were created. So we've got to think of those fat EBVs as carcass EBVs. Now, this is a little bit of a diversion, but in taking some of that fat off the outside of the animal, breeders started to find that maybe it was actually taking a little bit of fat off the cow as well. And so therefore started to back off that, and then I hear a lot of people talking about, well, this bull's good maternally because he's got positive fats. And really what they're saying is that they think that the daughters from that bull will maintain condition in the cow herd. So they're talking about cow condition score, not about fat around the carcass when they're looking for that. And again, a bit of a diversion, but actually our research has shown that relationship it's there, but it's only 25%, right? It's a very loose relationship. Mm-hmm. So looking at fat on the carcass of young animals is not a great indicator of looking at condition score of cows. So really, we need to have a condition score EBV. That's a whole separate topic. But we need to think about those fat EBVs in terms of carcass EBVs, mm-hmm. and realize that at best they're giving us a very loose indication of cow performance. And you've got to think about cow body condition score. It's not just fat, right? It's muscle as well that goes into condition score. So it's not surprising that just by measuring fat, we actually don't get a great indication of what's happening in cows anyway.
Yeah, well, it's interesting though, because I think probably, and I would have done this, you sort of think they're different sides of a three-sided coin, you know, intramuscular fat, rib fat, and beef cow condition fat. But there's, because that was the thing that you talked about, you know, there's an issue with too little fat, rib fat to avoid cold shortening. How often, or do we see an issue, or could there be an issue if we were selecting to tidy this up for beef cow condition? Because people want to have that fat on their cows, that walking haystack through the winter.
Yep.
Is there an issue then we risk getting over the 10 mil rib fat on carcasses and get too much?
Yep, there definitely is. I guess the thing is we can manage that somewhat by the time that we kill animals, mm-hmm. And the carcass, but the time we kill animals, the carcass weight we kill them at, and then their growth rates are all sort of intertwined, and I'm talking on a management sort of system now. Mm-hmm. You know, they are definitely three sides of the same yep. coin. And so really what we want is animals that will get the right amount of fat at the right carcass weight, and hopefully growing quickly enough to be still young and tender and maybe avoid that second winter and all those sort of things. So we're asking quite a bit.
But it is possible to achieve that holy sort of trinity, if you like, of the optimal level of rib fat with intramuscular fat, but not necessarily having skinny beef cows. And, you know, beef cows that are able to put on good condition and through winter, that sort of thing. You can do them all.
Yeah, you can do them all. And I'm not, just to be clear, I'm not advocating that we start selecting for low rib fats, because mm-hmm. I think if anything in New Zealand, and it's hard to get the data around this, right? And even the meat companies are interested in this, but we probably kill too many animals that don't have enough fat. That's probably a bigger problem for us than killing animals that have too much fat. We definitely get both. Mm-hmm. And it does depend on what our system is and what our carcass weights are and all those sort of attributes. But you know, typically, especially in the south down here, right, you know, it gets to start of May, duck shooting day. It's probably something close to your heart, looking at your background behind you there, Aaron. We get that first frost and it's right, everything's got to go. It's out the door, right, because we don't want those extra mouths on for winter. And in doing so, I think a lot of the time we will kill animals that have still got one growth potential left in them, but more, of greater concern probably is that they just don't have enough fat on them to really be killed and give an optimal carcass. But that probably happens right through the year as well to some extent.
So talking about images is not great podcast content,
no,
to be
it's
honest,
not.
Jason.
No,
but for those of you that can't see it, yeah, my background picture is a wetland, an 8-hectare wetland. So duck shooting and that. But it's a good benchmark, that first weekend in May. So I mean, what is the role of genetics here in this, though, then, if it's largely a kill date type thing and we tend to have too little? I mean, is it just we need people to get them growing faster so they are ready and have the fat covered before they have to get rid of them for the winter? Or is there still a genetic issue in there around subcutaneous fat?
Look, I think it's both, right? So, you know, growing our – to be maximum efficiency in our systems is to grow them – generally as fast as we possibly can. But, you know, what happens out there happens for a bunch of good reasons, right? We don't always have perfect conditions on farm either. I think really it's quite an individual thing too, in terms of for your farming system, when you kill cattle, the way you grow cattle, if you are getting too many elves, lean carcasses, then yep, you probably need to put a bit more finishing ability, or people might say softness, or you know, whatever words we want to use, into your cattle. But if you are sort of sitting at the top end on your system, and you know, you're getting sort of 8 or 9 average, which probably means that a bunch of them are going over 10 or 12, then you probably want to back off a little bit. So I think I find it very hard to give an answer that is applicable across the board to everyone. I think it's a bit of an individual thing, very system oriented. Yeah.
But it's not an either or, that's the thing. It's both, ultimately. It's both the system, the environment they're in, as well as the genetics, the genotypes you're running.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and if you're using some of the you know, the higher growth terminal type genotypes, then it's probably even more important, because you know, they're going to get to high carcass weights before they start putting the same levels of fat on. So again, yeah, so it's both the management, your system when you kill, but also what sort of genotypes you're using, and mm-hmm. then how they're performing in your system. So
So this podcast, we've talked in other ones about, you know, cattle finishing and systems. And again, I'll give us a bit of a punt here, a bit of a push here. Go and have a look at the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel. There's lots of ones on finishing systems generally, feeding systems generally, and beef cattle systems specifically. But let's stick to the beef genetics side of things. So that's the EBVs for fat depth and various, you talked about IMF as well and those sorts of things. How good, I mean, the progeny test is ultimately a chance to test some of those and see how well they're working. So how accurate were they? How good are they, those EBVs?
Yep, very good question. And so I'll just go back a step in terms of where the information comes from these, right? Mm-hmm. Because in the EBV systems that we have, the breed plan EBVs, or doesn't actually matter where, most of the data on what we call those carcass traits is actually collected using live animal ultrasound scanning on bulls and heifers within breeding herds. And it's rare that we actually get real carcass data into those analyses, but it can be valuable when it is, which I'll talk about in a second. And those scans, you need to get a certain level of fat on the animals to be able to have some variation for them to be able to show, you know, show the genetic differences they have. We've got a real challenge, particularly as we go towards selling yearling bulls, right, which is happening more and more in the last 2 or 3 years. To sell yearling bulls, we then need to get those scans done before that whole cohort of bulls is broken up and goes to the four corners of New Zealand. And that means that we're scanning these animals right on the edge of when we can really get good data out of them, because, you know, they're young bulls, and a 12-month-old bull doesn't have a lot of fat around the outside of it. So that is a challenge with our scanning and our scanning technology. Heifers, not so much a problem. We can scan them later and get really good data from them. So that's where the data is coming from. So then the question is, well, how good is that at predicting what happens in a carcass? And when we looked at the data from the beef progeny test, we actually found that the scan results that we did, and admittedly we were scanning steers and heifers because it was a progeny test, so we didn't have that bull issue, young bull issue, but the scans were remarkably lined up with the actual carcass measurements. And those scans were generally taken, a lot of the time they were taken at sort of 14 to 16 months, something like that, and then the carcasses weren't, most of those carcasses in that project were not killed until after the second winter. So often there was, you know, there could be easily a 6-month period between the scan and the later carcass, but it actually showed that the two measures were really closely related in terms of subcutaneous fat depth. So that's one thing. I think we can have a fair bit of confidence in that technology from a sub-fat depth. The second thing is marbling. And marbling scans were taken at the same time. Again, that's the same technology, ultrasound. And the correlation between the marbling and the scan and the marbling and the carcass later on was good, but it wasn't perfect. It was around about 70-75%. And that's been known. That's not really new information. But it's why breeders place a high premium on being able to have carcass data from the likes of progeny tests and that sort of thing, because the carcass data itself is a bit more, well, firstly, you get paid on carcasses, right? You don't get paid on ultrasound scans. And the carcass data itself in terms of marbling is just a little bit more accurate. So that's why we like it. But I guess I'll go back and say the correlation was still good. It's still a great indicator. And if you look historically, and you know, I hear this when I go to the US as well, and I think I'm sure you'd hear the same thing in Australia. We have moved when we've been using ultrasound as a tool to select for marbling, we've actually moved that population a long way. So the likes of talking with people from like Certified Angus Beef in the US, they will say that, you know, where it used to be a rarer thing for them to get prime in terms of their grading system, which is the top of their grading system over there. And so it didn't happen frequently enough for them to build specific brands around prime. And talking 15, 20 years ago, now they're getting enough cattle come through prime, you know, enough to actually create specific branded lines around this is prime, this is the best stuff you can get. And that's largely because of the genetics that we've used. I did say to them, has nutrition had any impact on it? And they said no. They might, because they were geneticists, right? but basically they're saying it's come about through genetics, through the genetic change that's been made in their population, where that they're getting a pretty significant shift. So that's a long-winded way of saying the EBVs work, and we've been using them well to make progress when we're focused on them.
The good thing in that, though, to pull up, you know, when people talk about or you talk there about the correlations have some variability, or it's there's outliers, that is a really good thing from a genetic point of view, though, is because you want those animals that are outliers, if you like, that at a certain rib fat depth, for example, have more. If you don't have variation in a genetic system, it's hard to make progress. That's the whole point.
Yep. So we want a nice tight correlation between the measure and the trait that we're trying to measure. So that's between like the IMF scan and the actual IMF of the carcass. We want that nice and tight. But you're absolutely right. The correlation between the actual rib fat and the IMF, and I don't carry these matrices or numbers around in my head, but it's around, from memory, it's around about 30%, right? Which actually means that you can find animals that put their effort into marbling and don't put so much around the outside. Or put it another way, depending on where you want to go in terms of your outside fat, you can pick that and then find a bull that also gives you marbling as well. So they're two sides of the same coin, but yep.
That's what I'm, and again, it's not great podcast material, but I've got the picture in front of me, and the highest marbling scores, etc., are not the animals with the highest rib fat depths, you know. So there is that. You don't just have to put on more and more rib fat, and you talked about all the reasons we don't want to do that to get that IMF, which we do want to get. So that's your opportunities and your genetic selection.
Exactly, and that's exactly why we have those two separate EBVs in the first place.
Yep. Good. Yep. So we'll come right back round to back that up. So, hey, look, all right, that's some of the key messages, and that went on for a bit longer than I wanted to, but that's good because we drilled into some of that stuff and expanded on it. So now I just want to run through a bit of the background, talk about what we're actually probably supposed to talk about in this when the people who arranged this podcast got you and I to do it, Jason. So just as well, they're not sitting and listening. They'll hear later. Let's talk about that. The beef progeny test, where a lot of this work has actually been done. Tell us about that, when it started, what's it been doing, what the purpose of it was.
Yeah. So it's evolved over the years, right? But it started with the first mating was December 2014. with first calves, obviously born in 2015. And at that point, we were working with five large commercial herds around the country from sort of just north of Gisborne, Central Plateau in the North Island, Southern Hawke's Bay, and then North Canterbury, and then in the Hakamatera Valley, not far from you. And they were all large properties. I think the smallest of them was probably 30,000 plus stock units. So they all had a bit of scale about them. And we ran a progeny test across those places. And there were a variety of aims. Some of it was demonstration or convincing people that EBVs worked. And that sort of became the early message and the thing that people hung on to. But actually, there's a whole lot of other reasons to do this work. And, you know, one of them is it gave us a really good data set to be able to look at some of these more in-depth issues like we've just been talking about. It showed, you know, the value of genetics and what good bulls can do in terms of performance. Some of those places had a real goal to up their compliance rate in terms of particularly back then, I think so the Silverfern Farms BFEQ reserve grade program had just come out in 2013. So people were really keen to up their compliance rate. And they did that through a combination of genetics and also management obviously plays a part in that. So there were a range of benefits that we've got out of that. I should give credit to who's now Dr. Frunze Vike, who did her PhD looking at all this data. And so a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about is actually her work. And there's more that can be extracted out of that at the moment. At the same time, and this is another, so we had beef and lamb also had a beef on dairy progeny test going at the same time. And across the years, largely those bulls were different, but we always managed to make sure we used 2, 3, 4 bulls that were in common. So at the moment, we've got a master's student at Massey who's working on looking at the data from a beef versus beef on dairy context too, to see, well, how can we put that data together? So again, another piece of research, but these things are not just academic research, right? They end up supporting data systems, supporting where we can go with genetics and the tools that we provide, but also supporting the confidence that farmers can have in terms of when they go and buy bulls. And you know, if they look at an EBV, if they're thinking about it in a beef context, will it also, you know, would the same EBV work in a beef on dairy context? So there's a whole lot of practical things that came out of that.
Yeah, and you touched on the scale of the original beef progeny test. I think the notes here say around 2,100 cows and heifers mated on the five. They were large scale properties by the standards. So, A, pretty applicable to most properties, and B, knowing what I know of some of the farm managers too, if you convinced them or they were keen on it, then you weren't going to pull the wool over their eyes to mix up my species. They were.
Exactly.
It was fairly. It wasn't just an academic exercise. You had some fairly solid rigor from the people that were running those places and taking part in the studies.
For sure, and some of them were a little bit skeptical about the value of the genetics at the outside of it, but agreed to do the project anyway. And as you say, the reason for choosing those large commercial places was that they are commercial, and you know, we weren't just dealing with overfed cattle. We were dealing with the real commercial reality, and properties of that scale, you know, that they can't change their management just to suit our project. They did change one or two things when they saw some results that came out of the project. And a classic example is when we showed graphs of conception rates of cows in an AI program or after an AI program and the follow-up bulls, and we looked at that against condition score. Then, you know, the next year when we came there, the cows had lifted a whole condition score because they saw what was happening on their property and actually realised that, you know, to get those cows back in calf, they they couldn't just punish them too much. They had to achieve a certain level without being silly about it. So, there was good learnings for those farmers.
And I will try and dig it out. I mean, you talked about it wasn't the main purpose of it. In fact, it wasn't necessarily the most important outcome, but there are some really neat graphs floating around showing that the EBVs work, that the correlation between the EBVs of the bulls used and what you actually measured in calf weaning weight, I think, for example, was an exceptionally good relationship. It was genuinely.
It was spot on what we would expect.
That's
a really key message that actually, at the end of the day, EBVs, they're just basically summaries of animals' performance measured in stud herds. And not surprisingly, they work. But more importantly, I guess they work in commercial herds too, because some people think, maybe they work when you're feeding animals really well, like a stud needs to. Uh-huh. Do they work commercially? Well, yeah, the answer was pretty clear. Yep, they would. You get the same differences expressed commercially.
Nice. We'll dig some of that out. But we touched earlier on about the Informing New Zealand Beef Project, and the original beef progeny test ran for 5 years from 2014. So 2019, 2020, it was wrapping up. But things didn't end there. What happened to the progeny test with sort of the role of the Informing New Zealand Beef Program from about 2020, 21 onwards? Where is it now? Yeah.
So we sort of moved into a different phase, and within the Informing New Zealand Beef Project, one of the goals of the project was to create the data that would enable sort of a cross-breed EBV analysis to happen at some point. And so I guess the properties that we'd worked with up until then, one or two of them had changes in terms of their management and sort of dropped out of the program, unfortunately. One was Taratahi. And the others probably were sort of feeling like they'd done their bit for industry, and they definitely had, like, they put in a huge effort because there were five or six years of calves born, but then you've got to follow those calves through for another couple of years as well. So it's a long-term commitment and a lot of work that they put into this. So in the new program, we're looking probably more, focusing a little bit more on crossbreeding or a crossbreed comparison. And we started off at Kepler Farm, which is a Pāmu farm down near Manapouri, and they did something that created the ideal situation for us, or they sort of said to us, what would be ideal? And we said, well, ideally we'd like to have Hereford and Angus cows running alongside each other in purebreds and then cross them both ways. And that's a pretty hard situation to find. There's not that many places that do that. And they went out and bought a bunch of Hereford heifers and to enable that for us. So the first year we used a bunch of the same bulls that we'd used in the old project. We used them in the new project to create those sort of links to tie the data sets together. Mm-hmm. And then since then we've been mating those Hereford and Angus cows both ways with Hereford and Angus bulls, and that helps us compare the crosses, and we can work out the hybrid vigor, but we can also work out what those breeds are doing maternally, what's the maternal difference between them, and demonstrate what happens with crossbreeding, right? And I use the word demonstrate advisedly because, there's been a heap of crossbreeding work done across the years. So hybrid vigor is not a surprise, but it's the sort of information that we need to be able to quantify that and put it in the back of analyses. So after a year of Kepler, and we've kept on going with Kepler, we also added in Lochinvar Station, which is owned by Rimanui, up on the Central Plateau between on the Napier-Taupo Highway. And they had an Angus cow herd, and we have used Hereford and Angus bulls, and we use the same bulls across both properties at Lochinvar, but we also added in Simmental bulls to Lochinvar because Simmental are the third largest breed in New Zealand beef cattle. So we've sort of got those three large, most dominant breeds covered now. We've also been working a little bit with the Shorthorn Association who have run their own progeny comparison as well, which we provide a bit of funding and a bit of advice to that as well. But really, we talk about Loch and Var and Kepler as the ones that we really, our main focus is on. And yeah, it's really about that data, but you know, it's also about the performance of the individual bulls. So people get feedback on how those bulls are going. And yeah, so we continue to do that.
So one quick question. So on Kepler, you had the purebred Herefords, the purebred Anguses, and then the crosses. So you've actually got four lines of cows there, an Angus Hereford cow and a Hereford Angus, you know, Hereford bull over an Angus cow, Angus bull over a Hereford cow. You've kept four. Yep. Yeah, so she's fairly complex for that place to run.
Yeah, it is. And we don't, unfortunately, and you know, while in the geneticist in me wants to keep unlimited animals, right, and measure them right through to the end of their life and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, with the female side of it, we can't keep them there forever because we just run out of room on the property. And so what we say is we want to keep them there for two matings. So we actually mate them as a yearling naturally using natural service rather than AI so that we're really representing, you know, commercial reality or real mating systems. We get their calf that gets weaned. And in the meantime, we've rebred them and we'll scan them to see what their pregnancy results are. So essentially we're getting the data from two matings. But then often those cows will be transferred to another property or we'll lose track of those property, those cows after they've weaned that first calf of theirs. So, but the power of crossbreeding is in that maternal female. So, you know, at least we've got those two matings worth of data to get that information.
So it gets complex pretty quick and the numbers get pretty big, especially when you're dealing with a beef cow as opposed to a ewe. But no doubt you'll be asked, is there any chance to, you've got the three main breeds, but any chance to add more or any plans to, or is that a matter of funding and finding the right properties?
Yeah, it's always a matter of funding and finding the right properties. Yeah. And I have been asked by another association. I think, it's a matter of whether we have funding, and it's also a matter of them finding the right property, you know, and I guess, you know, it's easier to help those who help themselves.
Fair enough. You can't, it's just such a, time and space and money are all an issue.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, we'd love to go even deeper and work with all the breeds in New Zealand. But from a levy payer point of view, we've got limitations, so we need to sort of go with where the significant majority is.
So actually bring it back a wee bit. What we were supposed to be talking about in this podcast with some of the finishing genetics and things was from Franzi's analysis of the first, the progeny test, those 5 years, 2014 to 2019. But just while we're on it, where to from here? So this the new progeny test or the new program on Kepler and Loch and Var, what's going to come out of that? More on what Franzi's analysed, or what's the real target you're trying to pull out there? What are we going to be talking about in 5 years' time?
Well, I guess, and these objectives were set a while ago, but you know that data will enable breeding values to be compared across breeds, and that hasn't happened at this point of time, but hopefully we get there. It will need buy-in from the bull breeders of New Zealand, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's where we need to focus a lot of our efforts. But we're not alone in doing this, right? So in America, there is a large crossbreed analysis run by what's called International Genetic Solutions, which is essentially an operating division of the American Simmental Association. So they are doing a large crossbreed analysis, but they don't have all the breeds in there. There are some breeds that still sit out, do their own analysis. And in Australia, actually, they are also running a significant project that will support a crossbreed analysis. So, you know, the ultimate goal would be to simplify bull buying to the point that that we're focusing on we can compare EBVs that we see, we can compare them, you know, across all breeds that are comparable. That would be the ultimate. And then we can focus a little bit on the bull and its genetics more than just the breed. I think, and you know, this is probably a statement that I'm happy to make and repeat, but some people might take umbrage with it, but I think we've underutilized crossbreeding in New Zealand. You know, it is probably the lunch that's almost free. It can be challenging to implement, but there are other, you know, there are a bunch of ways of utilizing crossbreeding in our herds, and that's a whole different topic in itself. But you know, it is a known and proven pathway to improving performance.
So, because it's interesting,
and we've used it in our sheep industry extensively, right?
Which is exactly where I was going. And you know, the last it's easy to lose sight, but when you two step back and realize just how far sheep genetics has changed in the last 2.5 decades, and I use that term specifically because that's roughly when Sheep Improvement Limited and some of the central work was first rolled out, and there was quite a dramatic change in the industry. Is that, and just for those of you that aren't, or those that aren't that familiar in our listeners, is that sort of where some of this work is going to, the equivalent? It's improved now for the beef industry, more centralized, more cross flock, cross herd, cross breed analyses?
That would be where we'd ideally like to take it. Yep. And yeah, just sort of, yeah, helping people make decisions with objective information. And, you know, and, but I should say in doing this, this is not about destroying pure breeding either, because you need pure breeds to have crossbreeds. And so, you know, sometimes the perception's out there that, oh, beef and lamb doesn't like breed associations, or it doesn't like pure breeding. That I'll be pretty clear, that's not the case at all. And, you know, pure breeding is actually where you make the improvements year on year. So, but you also get that extra extra icing on the cake from crossbreeding as well, and both take you in a positive direction.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's not about, for us, it's not about a breed or a crossbreed. It's about the right tools for people to discover information, and then farmers make those decisions. The interesting thing is, as you say, how strong, certainly the sheep side of things, some of the purebreds have become, because A, there's competition, but B, that information never hurts, knowing more about what your opportunities are within your breed, whatever it is where the opportunity lies. Okay, let's get back onto some of this sort of stuff, just some of the key points I wanted to cover up. So the note I've got here, and I guess I'm asking you a question about work that you know well, but it was Franzi has analysed a whole lot of this stuff. It was about 4,500 cattle have been ultrasounded so far for carcass trays in the beef progeny test. That's a fairly large data set. But as you referred to earlier, that's using ultimately externally on a live animal, trying to predict some things we want to know about internally and what's going to be a dead animal. And it may be a wee bit later after you've done the ultrasound stuff. So how good was that ultrasound measure on live animals as a predictor of what we were going to end up with dead, particularly in intramuscular fat? I guess you said it was pretty accurate for subcutaneous fat, but is it useful for getting an idea of what we're going to get with IMF?
Yeah, look, I'd say it was very accurate for subcutaneous and good accuracy for intramuscular fat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a useful tool. It's useful in genetics. It struggles. It's at the margins in terms of predicting on individuals. Some of the companies have done some of that work in terms of, can you use it to scan when an animal is ready to kill? And yes, you can, but you'll still get quite a bit of variability. Is the answer for that on an individual. So from a management tool, it's got its use, but it's not perfect. But from a genetics tool, because in genetics, an EBV, like on a bull, is really an average across, you know, 10, 20, 30 progeny, averages across those sort of numbers are actually much more accurate than individual information, right? So EBV analysis basically put together a whole lot of information. And so things that aren't necessarily perfectly accurate When you're looking at an individual basis or on a management basis, you put them into a genetic evaluation system, and actually with the power of numbers and the power of stats, we can get good, accurate estimates, even when the measurement's not perfect.
So that was sort of leading on to ultimately what we want to get to with this is the research is interesting, the science, the tests, they're very interesting, the genetic side of things, but for Beef and Lamb New Zealand in particular, it's about our beef farmers. What does it all mean to them? How are they going to use it?
Yep. So I guess one is a confidence thing, right? So we can be really confident in the information that is out there. Secondly, we would like to look at new bits of information and maybe do some things better than what we've done in the past. And I guess I'm talking going forward now rather than what we've got in the can yet. But, you know, an example is we've got more and more issues with parasites in this country. And a lot of the noise around that's in sheep, but we know that we're not far behind in beef. In fact, there's been properties identified with you know, multiple drench resistance in cattle as well now. You know, so as a question, and we haven't actually committed to this yet, but I've been asking breeders in the last couple of months, whenever I get in front of a group of breeders, you know, should we be looking at parasite resistance EBVs as a tool? And generally at least 50% of the audience are putting their hand up and saying, yep, because I think we're going to have more and more systems with younger cattle and them, you know, intensively finished as well. So it's that issue is not likely to go away for us. So that's an example. Feed intake's always interesting to breeders because that's sort of feed efficiency of operations. It's actually where I started my career 30 years ago, sorry. The feed efficiency is also associated with, or feed intake is also associated with methane production. So there's potentially angles that we can improve the environmental outputs of our cattle and tell the environmental story, I suppose, in our markets. So there's a bunch of new things that we can look at as well.
Cool. And bringing it back to the one of the key ones we started talking at the start around subcutaneous fat and so on, what's the, and you've talked about how some of it's management, the time of kill, where the animal's ready to go, et cetera, but in terms of the EBVs for subcutaneous fat, for EBVs for intramuscular fat, and I think you know, you talked a bit about rump fat and so on, for a farmer that's wanting to hit that target, the 3 to 10 mils, and then ideally at the same time get more IMF in there for product value and all those sorts of things, what do you suggest they do with all the stuff we've found out of the beef progeny test? How can they use that to improve those particular trays?
Yep. So if you're going for a premium program where you're going to get paid for marbling and you want to produce, you know, premium eating quality, maximize the marbling that you can, the marbling EBV. So look at the EBV when you buy your bulls, and focus on getting a good marbling EBV. For your fats, think about whether you need to put more or less on the carcass. And sort of adjust the dial a little bit based on that. At the moment, it's still the only tool when we're thinking about cow body condition, but one of the things that we're doing right now is encouraging breeders to actually measure cow body condition and then have a cow body condition score, EBV, which we can calculate for them. So so if you're thinking about cow body condition, you know, then ask your breeder about whether they're going to be part of, you know, have EBVs on cow body condition score available and focus on those rather than on fat for cow body condition. I guess what I'm saying in saying that is we don't want to push fat up too far either, because we'll have to push it a long way forward to get a small increase in cow body condition score compared to actually directly targeting cow body condition. So fat's it's hard to give a solid answer, but because it does depend on your system at the moment.
Yep. But one of the very, and you touched on it there, with leaving aside the genetics, one of the very first things I think you suggest is have a look at your kill sheets, see where you actually are and what is achievable, feasible. If, you know, for if you're talking to and every farm's different, every farm is different, but let's, you know, talk a typical beef farm, watch how many should they have falling within range? I mean, what would you expect? There's going to be some outside, or is it perfectly feasible to say you'd be getting 95, 98% plus within that fat class P that we're after?
Yeah, look, I think it's just probably it's probably fairly feasible to say 90% at least, because you can draft frequently and draft when you hit that. And yes, it's you know, you're making a visual assessment, or your stock buyer's making a visual assessment, but you know, a good visual assessor can get a reasonable indication of fat on the animal. So I think that with the right sort of management, the right drafting program, kill program, and yeah, there's always going to be some that fall out of spec. We know, we always know we've got that tail end in our herd, and also sometimes just that, I guess, wouldn't call it a tail end, but you know, those shorter animals, those animals with less growth potential that just go to fat really fast. So they're probably both going to fall out of spec on either side. And then, you know, there's our climate events and all those sort of things that force us to make decisions sometimes. But overall, I think it's achievable to get, you know, a good solid percentage in spec.
Nice. So there's a target, and I guess the idea is, if you're not achieving that, why not? And there may be perfectly good reasons, but if there is the opportunity to improve more, that's some of what we've talked about today. So if people want to find out more, we've covered a fair bit in our 50-odd minute podcast, Jason, but where do we go to find this information, to look it up, to view it, to listen to it, to read it? What's out there?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things out there, but I guess the first port of call would always be Beef and Lambs Knowledge Hub, where we try and put as much of this sort of information in a variety of formats there as we can. So head there first.
Awesome. And we will put some links in the blurb, because as part of the background notes to this, I had some background reading, which I think would be also of interest to people that have listened to it, around the effectiveness of ultrasound scanning at predicting marbling, ultrasound and rib fat carcass depth, and fat on the inside versus fat on the outside, which basically those three topics sum up just what we've spent nearly an hour chatting about. So look, we've sort of covered a fair bit, Jason, and we've at times taken sideways turns and come back, but that's the beauty of your podcast. Sure. Is there anything, last chance though, is there another sidetrack or anything you wanted to cover or thought you're going to cover today that you haven't, that we can?
Oh, that's a dangerous question. That's a dangerous question to ask me, Aaron. I could talk cattle genetics all week if you wanted, because I'm very passionate about it. But we probably should leave it at that. I think you're right. We've gone down a few sidetracks. Hopefully they're still relevant. And it's amazing to think that we can sit here talk for an hour and talk about a subject that at the end of the day is as small and specific as, you know, fat EBVs and carcasses, but there's a lot to think about.
Only the scratching the surface. But yeah, look, we'll put some links in there, because there's various field days and things happening, as well as just some of the extension materials that we have on the website. There's a chance to, we just missed it this year, but recently you had a fairly popular field day at Lochinvar, wasn't there?
We try and do a, we did a day up there. We did a day at Kepler the year before, just to sort of show people what's happening there, but also to put out a few of these messages and that sort of thing as well. So talked about a lot of the stuff. Some of the stuff we talked about was what we've just covered. We talked about other stuff as well.
So keep an eye on the Beef and Lamb New Zealand e-diaries and website if that's of interest, to go and see this in the flesh, that it's not just imagination and made up numbers. You can see the actual beasties there. But I think that's probably a good point to wrap it up, Jason. So thank you very much for your time. And I think this might be the first podcast in a series, so I'm not sure whether it's you coming back or others to talk about some of the other things that have come out. But looking forward to it.
I think we should try and get some of the rest of the team involved as well. just to take the listener back who can't see behind you, Aaron, but you've got your duck pond there, and I know duck shooting's coming up, and you're an avid duck shooting fan, so good luck with duck shooting this year.
There's also a week away for the Raw coming up, hence why I had to get the podcast done today, because otherwise we weren't going to get it done before all those things got in the way. So
sounds like a lot of things are going to die in the next month.
Very good. Awesome. Thank you, Jason.
Cheers.
See you later.
Okay, see ya.